First, The Rock says rubber guns only. Now, one of TV's favorite cops is doubling down. The Shield's Michael Chiklis joins A-list actors calling the tragedy of Rust a turning point. Plus, two of the country's most politically polarizing criminal trials have begun, and they've already got jury problems. In the age of cable news and social media, how hard is it to pick a jury? Then, Joe Exotic wants out of his cage. On the eve of Tiger King 2 dropping on Netflix, Joe is dropping news of his own and asking a judge for mercy. All ahead on Banfield. Hello and welcome to Banfield. It has been 2 weeks since a rising star in the film world was shot to death on a project that, by most accounts, not all, was rushed and stretched and troubled. And now a rising chorus of big-name actors and others are calling on film sets to ban real guns. And we're going to hear from them in a moment. But we are also hearing yet again from the lawyers for the woman whose number one job was making sure the real guns being used on the movie set of Rust were safe. She's Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, the armorer. And on this program yesterday, we heard her lawyers claim that someone may have slipped a live bullet into a box of dummy rounds on purpose. And the reason? To cause real harm. No matter how wild that claim may seem, it is still the armorer's job to keep live bullets off the set and at all costs out of any real gun that might be on a set. But there you go. I want to break her latest statement down point by point with the help of criminal defense attorney Joe Tacopina, whose list of famous clients include Meek Mill, Jay-Z, Sean Hannity, and Michael Jackson. We're also pleased to welcome Steve Wolf. He is a stunt coordinator and a firearms expert. And if there's someone who's going to know what's wrong with some of the statements coming out, I think it's going to be both of these guys. Gentlemen, thank you. Actually, Steve, I just want to begin with you because Hannah is being defended so often by these two lawyers and by her own statements being released. I'm not sure she's doing herself any favors. So with your expertise, I want to read for you part of this statement that, her lawyers released for her today. And it says this: Hannah was incredibly safety conscious and took her job very seriously from the moment she started on October 4th. She did firearms training for the actors as well as Mr. Baldwin. Steve, Mr. Baldwin was the one who handled that gun and is also a producer. So how good will her firearms training be if the person she trained didn't look to see that the gun he was holding was okay?
I'd say this would not speak well to her training ability.
I think that's a fair statement, but I mean, at this point, have you ever heard of an armorer in the business who thinks that just training the actor is enough? Handing it off and making sure the AD and the actor do this is just enough?
No, this is like, you know, training wild tigers. You still stand there with a whip and make sure that they stay in line. You teach an actor basic gun safety. You teach them how to inspect the firearm so that they know its condition, whether it's loaded, and if it is loaded, what it's loaded with. And then you stay there and you supervise to make sure that everything you taught is being done correctly. And clearly,
that's what
that
I
was
thought.
Not done at all.
Yeah, I mean, that just sort of stands to reason. That's exactly what I thought. Joe Tacopina, with your lawyer's hat, because I know you know a lot about actors and famous cases and all the rest, but strictly speaking as an attorney, this comment next that came from these attorneys read this way: she fought for more training days and she regularly emphasized to never point a firearm at a person. And yet, on her first movie just in August, the key grip, Stu Brumbaugh, said that she would carry firearms under her armpits, pointing backwards at people on the set. And isn't this the kind of thing that if this ends up in litigation in any way, that will make it into the case?
Sure. A prior pattern of conduct will enter into any sort of litigation when it comes to one's actions and determine whether they've done this before or if they have a propensity to do things like this. Look, there's two different types of cases, right? Actually, there's criminal and civil. When we're talking about civil cases, standards are much lower. And here, clearly, there's civil liability all over the place, from the producers to her. But there's also a criminal element afoot here. Let's not be you know, mince words. I mean, somebody introduced a live round into a dummy round box. Someone introduced a bullet. There's no reason in the world, well, I think we could all agree, including the weapons expert, Steve, that a live round of ammunition should be on a movie set. Zero reason. Someone put it there with bad intentions. So there's a crime that was committed, a serious crime. It's a matter of who did it and why they did it. Well, and that's what the question,
Joe, I'm going to jump in. I don't think there were bad intentions. Maybe there were reckless intentions. I mean, I don't want to suggest for a minute that there were any intentions here. I just think there may have been a degree of negligence and recklessness that does rise to the criminal level. You were going to say something, Steve.
No, actually, I disagree with you. Wait. Why would a real life bullet round get introduced into a movie set? Why? There's no reason for that. So someone did that. It wasn't negligence. They didn't come to work that day and say, oh, I have an extra bullet. I'm going to throw it into the dummy box. I mean, according to these lawyer statements, someone introduced a live round into the dummy round ammunition box. So
yeah, but I'm not so sure that's what happened. And you know what? I'm not so sure that the lawyers have it right. I think they're not part of this investigation and they're just deflecting everywhere they can. But Steve, I think you have a theory on this.
Yeah, Ashley, I agree with you. And the fact that live ammo ended up on the set or in a box or in the gun, that's definitely not, you know, any evidence of sabotage, but certainly evidence of negligence. You know, if the people had been out shooting that day, they'd been plinking with those guns, they came back, they said, oh, there's the gun table, I've got a couple extra rounds I didn't use, there's a box, looks like ammo, I'll stick them back in there. I'm doing somebody a favor by putting this away. There's no evidence that there was, you know, foul play or ill intent there, but certainly gross negligence enough for everybody.
Yeah, and I think, Joe, what you're saying is that the lawyers are saying somebody sabotaged this set and did it, but they have no information from the New Mexico investigation that is part of anything at this point.
No, I'm not saying that they have information that someone did that. Obviously, there'd be arrests, I think, happening if they knew that someone did that. But the point is, there's no reason for a live ammunition to come onto a movie set. And that's not something that happens by accident. I mean, you don't take the guns out of a movie set prop kit and go target shooting with them.
That's what they did.
You just don't do that. So
that's what they did.
I'm only going to jump in here.
That's where there's criminal negligence.
The plinking, this, you know, target practice, no one has been able to prove this out yet. It's a report in the media. The sheriff has said he has not heard any evidence or testimony yet from their questioning in their investigation of it. So this may actually not bear out to be true. So if we can get the plinking and the stupidness out of the story, now we have a whole other fact pattern. And to that, I want to read this comment next from the attorney statement today on behalf of Hannah. Never in a million years did Hannah think that live rounds could have been in the dummy round box. Steve, with your background in film, with your background in firearms expertise, with your background as a prop expert, isn't that actually the job of the armorer? Like, to make sure that whatever the hell is in that gun, whether it's in the barrel accidentally, if it's a piece of sand or a pebble or a shoelace or whatever might accidentally get in there, is out of there. Shine a light. Check it twice. Check it three times. Because otherwise, Steve, correct me if I'm wrong, you do not need an armorer on a set. You can have an intern do it.
Right. The entire purpose of the armorer and their supposed expertise is to make sure that nothing gets into a gun that's going to hurt anyone. And the idea of, you know, I don't know how this could have happened. You know, it's your job to know how this could have happened. You know, the first rule of safety is never underestimate the stupidity of what may be done by the people around you. And you have to anticipate that people are going to do dumb things because people do. And you check for it and you make sure every time you pick up the gun, you unload it. If there's anything in there, you assess what that is. If the correct rounds are in there, you put them back in there. You check them. There is a very easy way to distinguish between dummy rounds and live rounds. And if it's supposed to be dummy rounds in there, you put those back in. If they're supposed to be blanks in there, you put those back in. And if you're just doing blocking rehearsals, you make sure there's nothing in there. And after you've checked, you bring the gun to the actor and you show them, hey, I'm opening all the cylinders here. I'm showing you. Because once I put this gun in your hands, you're responsible for what happens with it. So I want you to know how to check its condition. And if you don't know,
and
I'm going to show you.
And they all go through safety training. They go through the safety courses. The actors go through the safety courses, the gun training in advance of a film. It's not as though this is all new to them. They've never heard this before.
Right.
So Joe Tacopina, again, I'm going to get you to do some assessment of how much damage this statement today by her lawyers may have actually done to her exposure, her criminal exposure. And let me read for you. These lawyers, releasing the statement for Hannah say, whoever put those live rounds in there and why is the central question. Hannah kept guns locked up, including throughout lunch on the day in question. Look at that carefully. Hannah kept guns locked up, including throughout lunch on the day in question. The problem is that yesterday these same two attorneys were on the Today Show and they were answering very specifically about the lunch period and where the guns were. The lunch period is 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. I'm just going to roll the tape and let them, indict themselves here. Take a look.
Let them put their feet in their mouth.
At 11, nothing was going on at that point. She had the guns prepped. She had them laid out on the cart. They then went to lunch. She came back. She had another duty and responsibility as key props assistant. And so she had gone to do that after she had provided the handgun to Mr. Halls. So Mr. Halls took custody of the weapon, and at that point, she was doing her other duties as a key prop assistant.
Oh, wow. Okay, Joe Tacopina. That's a statement today that says Hannah kept the guns locked up, including throughout lunch, and a statement yesterday saying Hannah put the guns, laid them out, and then had another duty and left and did her other thing. So as a lawyer, how does that happen?
Because lawyers are sloppy and lawyers make mistakes all the time and lawyers are overwhelmed by something. I mean, I don't know if these guys have ever been in the case that's garnered this much national media attention, but clearly they were saying things that maybe they didn't have command of the facts on. And that happens. Things like that happen. I've seen it happen in many high profile cases where lawyers say something. But remember, the lawyer statements were the ones who sort of contradict themselves. Hannah, this prop expert or the armorer, if you will, hadn't made those statements. So you can't attribute those statements to her. This is not a situation where she's going to get jammed up criminally or on the hook criminally for this. Look, I don't think this poor girl has any criminal liability. She has civil liability for sure. Ooh. As does the whole production set, as does the producer, as does the actor. There's unless you can show that she knew or should have known that there was a live round of ammunition in that gun.
She should have known. It's possible. It's her job. I can't even argue because you're so much better than this stuff than me. But I will also say this about these two lawyers and this last little nugget that we're chewing on. Her lawyer said on the Today Show yesterday with Savannah Guthrie that the guns were left for those 2 hours on the cart, right? 11 till 1. And yeah. Then the New York Times is saying they have since corrected themselves to say that the guns were only left 5 to 10 minutes. So 2 hours.
Which is why sometimes lawyers should speak.
Can I ask you a question? How did it become the lawyer's job to represent Hannah in the media rather than to put their efforts into building her defense case for the courtroom? Because every time they go on TV, it's just to change, to take their foot out of their mouth to change feet. They're not helping.
Yeah, Steve, but that's the problem. Yeah. The problem with that is there are lawyers. I've represented a lot of people in high profile cases. Sometimes it is the lawyer's job to represent the client in the media because sometimes the media is so indicting that client before the facts are out. You want them sort of balance public opinion before there's this preconceived notion of guilt. So there's a reason to do it. But one thing you don't do when you go into the media is not have a command of the facts. Because when you do that, this spills over to the client. It spills over to the client and makes her look like she's done something wrong. She's being nefarious, or she's hiding something, or because the inconsistent statements people are assuming came from her. It's not necessarily true. The lawyers could have just missed up, misstated something, or not been in command of the facts. And unfortunately, lawyers who aren't prepared to deal with this kind of a publicity matter are sometimes overwhelmed and make grave mistakes like these guys have already done.
Well, I'll tell you what, you guys just hit the nail on the head. And knowing the facts, when we come back after the break, the fact that I thought was the biggest was that, oh, dummy bullets look just like real bullets. Holy Toledo. Steve is going to show you folks exactly why that is the dumbest piece of malarkey I think I have heard in this case yet. They do not. I don't even know that much about bullets, but that I know. That much I definitely know. Dummies do not look like bullets, not if you're an armorer. So guys, stick around. Also, there's this huge thing that happened today. Some of the biggest names in Hollywood say there's just this simple solution here, and it has nothing to do with these dummies, doesn't have anything to do with blanks and distinguishing marks on cartridges. It has everything to do with this.
In television or film or otherwise, we will not use real guns ever again.
The Rock speaks, and The Shield backs him up. We've got that exclusively here on Banfield. And later, Joe Exotic. He rose to fame during pandemic binging of Tiger King. He's been locked up ever since, but now he wants a judge to show him some mercy. Wait till you hear why. Welcome back. Beyond the shock of the Rust shooting, a lot of non-movie people were shocked to learn movies do use real guns on set. Now, though, a lot of movies that otherwise would have won't be doing that. At last night's premiere of his new Netflix movie, Red Notice, a film with no shortage of guns and gunfire, A-list leading man Dwayne The Rock Johnson declared that he and his production company, $7, are taking a stand.
Moving forward on any $7 production, in television or film or otherwise, we will not use real guns ever again. We are going to be using rubber guns, and we'll take care of it in post. And we won't worry about the dollars. We won't worry about math or what the cost is. I think we're going to do it the right way. And that's what we're going to do at $7.
And there's more. Today, I spoke with tough guy actor Michael Chiklis, who rose to fame as L.A. detective Vic Mackey on the hit FX show The Shield. He's on set shooting in Texas, but he told me this exclusively. I have fired tens of thousands of blank rounds on camera over the course of my career, and I see no reason for any of us to use a real weapon on a set ever again. Every weapon from this day forward could easily be replaced with extremely realistic prop guns that are simply unable to fire rounds of real ammunition, thereby ending any possibility of such a tragedy occurring again. And that guy should know. He's known as one of the toughest cops on TV, wielded weapons forever. Still with me, criminal defense attorney Joe Tacopina, firearms expert and stunt coordinator Steve Wolf. Okay, guys, I'm just going to go back to this business of these attorneys and what they have said today, especially in light of what everyone in Hollywood is now saying. Hannah's attorneys actually claimed that live rounds and dummies are often indistinguishable. And I want to play what they actually said out of their own mouths on the Today Show yesterday. Take a look at this.
Once it was time for that weapon to go onto the set, did Hannah inspect the gun, the chamber? Did she look at the cartridges and determine that they were dummy cartridges?
She did not.
Okay. There's one other piece of tape I want you to hear from that show, because I think it's very telling, and it is about the indistinguishable nature of dummy rounds and real round. So I'm going to ask the control room, if you can, just get that soundbite queued up, if you can, where he talks about looking at the dummy rounds and the projectile tip. Take a look.
She did spin the cylinder for him. She did show him each and every round in that chamber, which there were six. There were six dummy rounds she believed to be in that handgun. She spun it and showed it all to Mr. Halls. The problem is, and when you look at a dummy round and you look at their appearance, they have the same projectile tip. Some of these do not have a hole in the side of them. They mimic and look like a real round. And on that scene and that set at that time, Hannah spun it for Mr. Halls. He took the weapon, and then he went into the church, and thereafter provided it apparently to Mr. Baldwin.
Okay, Steve Wolf, I am just going to hand this over to you to tell me and Joe, I'm sure Joe already knows, and the rest of the audience, how woefully wrong it is to say that they're indistinguishable from one another, especially for an armorer.
Absolutely. This is like the doctor not knowing between the difference between a scalpel and a retractor. Yeah, they're both medical gear, but who can tell the difference? Well, if you can't, then it's you shouldn't be on that set. Yes, correct. They both have a bullet on the tip. They both have casings. If you can distinguish here, this one here has an unfired primer. This one here has a fired primer. If you're visually impaired and you prefer auditory means, this live round, when you shake it, makes no sound because the powder is quiet. It's like a CAPTCHA. Do you want to see it or do you want to hear it? The dummy rounds have BBs in them. Very distinguishable. So you shake each one. If you feel the BBs, you hear them, you know, and you see that the primer's been expended, then you have a dummy round. And then you go ahead and you load that.
Can I just ask you, hold 1 second before you load it. The camera was a little tricky to see the primer, but is it the difference between a Chad and a pregnant Chad? Like the primer sticks out like a pregnant belly if it's a real round and it's a concave. It's sort of hard to make it out.
Okay.
But yeah.
It has a dimple hit into it made by the hammer when you expend it. Versus this clean one here, hoping that that's focusing for you.
So if you're looking in the barrel, you can see it. You can, even if you don't pull them out, shake it.
There's no way to see into the barrel of this because it's not removable here. But what you can do is you can look into each of the chambers of the cylinder.
The chambers, yeah.
Yeah,
and that's
so
what she did when she spun.
And you can see that there's nothing
like she
there.
She spun the cylinder, right?
Sorry about the delay.
But she spun it. You should have been able to see.
Okay, well, if I load this gun with six rounds of live ammo, and I spin the cylinder here, if I spin the cylinder in here after I load it, you know, there's a live round in there right now. Now I'm going to spin the cylinder.
Careful.
Yeah, well, I am careful. Okay, so does spinning the cylinder remove any of those rounds or remove the danger? Not at all. So spinning the cylinder is a useless thing to do. Opening the cylinder, removing what's in there, and inspecting it is what makes it safe. Not spinning. This is just, you know, playing with guns. That's not making anything any safer. You got to know what's in each cylinder of the gun, or you haven't done anything except, you know, a meaningless show and tell.
Yeah, so listen, I don't know when they say that she inspected all the rounds, and I'll give this last one real quick to you, Joe Tacopina, 20 seconds left. The lawyer said she inspected the rounds, and they also said that she handed it off to Mr. Halls by spinning the cylinder and showing him all the rounds. I just say there's one or two things here. Either she loaded a live one in and didn't know it, or she doesn't know what a live one looks like if her lawyers are saying she did the inspection. How do you see it, Joe?
You're right. It's one of the two. Either one's a bad thing, and either one will create massive civil liability. So there's no question she's civilly liable. The Rust production crew is civilly liable. Baldwin's civilly liable. They're all civilly liable. Someone introduced a live round of ammunition into a movie set. That person is criminally liable, whoever that person is, actually.
So I'll only close this way, guys. And that was, then I asked the sheriff, did you check Hannah's pockets? And they said yes. And I said, what was in them? And they said, we won't say. So I'm really curious to find out what that yields when that information, you know, comes available. Hey, guys, you're just great.
I do want to add that this is a real gun. This is a real gun, and this is a prop gun that can only fire blanks. And if you try to put live ammo into this gun, it won't go in. So there's no reason in this case to have used live guns. But live guns are used safely by people who know what they're doing all the time.
I like that comment, you know, because that could be the happy medium that's met. Because I know that the recoil is a big deal for, you know, realism in filming, and you're not going to get that with a rubber gun and post.
Well, you
effects.
Don't get it with there's no recoil with a blank either. So there's no issue about recoil.
Yeah, don't you get the gunfire explode? Like you get the gunpowder exploding. Don't you get
muzzle blast coming out? But recoil is based on action and opposite reaction.
Interesting.
So when the bullet goes out, that makes the gun recoil. But when hot gas comes out, there's no recoil.
Okay. Well, you know what? I didn't know that. So this is value added. Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Steve Wolf. Good to have you.
Thanks for
the show and tell. Joey Tack, always good to have you as well. Joe Tacopina joining us. We go back a long way, so I sure appreciate it. All right, gentlemen. Still to come, two massive trials involving race are just underway right now in America. But how fair do you think they're going to be? Are the victims being tried? Can the jurors put aside what they've seen on the news? Is the trial process itself right now on trial? There are two racially charged cases that have hit the courtroom this week. And even though one trial's in the South and the other one's in the North, they both have one really big thing in common: skin color, especially when it comes to the jury. Let's start in the North, where a teenager is on trial, charged with shooting to death two men and wounding another. It happened during the Kenosha riots in Wisconsin. Those were riots that were sparked by the police shooting of a black man named Jacob Blake in that community. The teenager, Kyle Rittenhouse, wasn't from Kenosha, but he left his home in Antioch, Illinois, and he drove across state lines to be there for the protests, where he borrowed a gun from a friend. Kyle's now 18. He's facing first-degree murder, but he says he shot those three people in self-defense. And already this early in the case, a juror has been bounced for making flip comments about how many shots it took for the police to kill Jacob Blake, the killing that sparked the protests. But that is not the only glaring jury issue today. Down south in Brunswick, Georgia, three white men are on trial for the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. You might remember Ahmaud as the young black jogger who was shot to death after being chased down by three neighbors who thought he was breaking into a construction site. And lo and behold, there are problems with that jury, too. Even though that community is 55% black, there is only one black person on that jury. I want to bring in criminal defense and civil rights attorney Mark O'Mara and jury consultant Ronald Beaton, the president of Trial Behavior Consultants. And welcome to both of you. I'm going to start with this. So in the Rittenhouse case, guys, there was one of the jurors who was picked, somehow got through voir dire and made a joke to a sheriff's deputy. And I can't tell you the joke. It's really upsetting. It's mean. But it had to do with how many shots it would take to kill Jacob Blake. And I guess, you know, Mark O'Mara, my question to you is how did he get picked? If it's that bad that he's joking like that with one of the deputies, how does this happen?
Well, because 20 years ago or so, the idea of stealth jurors, which are jurors who want to get on the panel for having to do reasons of their own, nothing to do with the facts, the law, they had their own agenda ahead of time. Stealth jurors were an anomaly. We didn't know much about them. We knew they were out there. But I've got to tell you, now all of a sudden, everybody who looks at a case and has a position about it knows that it's not too hard to get on a jury if you want to. And I think this witness was a perfect example of somebody who obviously had some biases, some insensitivities, if not active biases. And yet he was able to walk through the jury process, I think, quite honestly, in part because this judge did not allow for a thorough jury jury investigation to happen. And now he shows up, and very easily, if he hadn't said that joke to that deputy, He was back saying it in the jury deliberation room and carrying not only his own biases, but how they would have infected everybody else in the jury. And unfortunately, in today's day and age, that's happening more and more.
Okay, so real quickly, Ronald Beaton, I want to ask you about something the judge in this case also did. He said that the prosecution in this case cannot refer to the two dead people as, quote, victims, but the defense is allowed to call folks rioters and even looters if it's proven that they did do looting. So you get the idea of behavior and language and the effect on jurors. What do you make of that? Do you think that that's going to be, you know, damning in terms of what the jury hears and how they characterize the evidence?
I think it hurts, Ashley. I think to not be able to call them victims when they were shot. It's surprising. I think the reasoning goes that he's claiming self-defense, and so under that, you know, until they can prove that they were shot unreasonably, I think the judge thought, well, you can't call them victims if they're not victims of a crime, and the crime hasn't been proven yet. So,
I've heard it before.
Yeah, it's not
that I haven't heard that before. I always just find it really tricky because now you're questioning the legitimacy of the dead people and they're not there to speak for themselves. I want to switch real quickly over to the Arbery and McMichael case. So 11 white jurors, one black juror, 55% of the population there is black. So that doesn't seem quite right. And then when it was questioned, the judge actually had something to say about it. I want to roll that. Take a look at this.
This court has found that there appears to be intentional discrimination in the panel. I have very adept counsel here, and they've been able to explain to the court why, separate from race, those individuals were in fact struck from the panel. It does not change the fact that that initial finding was out there. It doesn't feel like that is how it worked, but it's been explained to the court under the terms of Batson, why those particular strikes were made.
Oh, okay. Mark O'Mara, if you don't spend a lot of time in a courtroom, that sounds a little confusing. He actually said there seems to be some intentional discrimination there. And then he said Batson and not, you know, that's not colloquial for everybody. But effectively, what the heck just happened? Because if the judge noticed it, is there a Batson challenge here, which is, I want to see their notes. I want to see what their secret reasons were for striking all the black jurors. I want to see if there's little codes for, that's a black guy, I don't want him. Is that not going to happen?
It's not going to happen because lawyers are not that stupid. If you're going to go in and try and get yourself a racially biased jury, then you just have to look at the color of skin. And I'm not blaming the defense counsel for that, but that's the way it works. Batson came out years and years ago to try and stop what was unquestionably bias in the jury selection process against minorities. And Batson is pretty good because what Batson says is, hey, we have to be careful here. What is your race-neutral reason for striking this juror? And if you can come up with one, and it's not pretense, and the judge is actually making a determination, it's not pretense, then it's allowed. But I will tell you, Batson was a start. Washington State has a jury instruction that every state needs to look at and talk about and accept. And that says we are all biased, and we have to be so, so careful with our biases and how they infect the jury system that we're going to presume those biases exist and puts even more of a burden on the person who's exercising the strike.
Right.
So Washington should be the way we should all do it. Batson was a start. And now we have such a obviously racially inappropriate jury for such a high profile case. I think the judge should do more about it than just comment on it.
So, Ronald, if you're sitting in a courtroom and you're watching the voir dire go on, doesn't it start to look fishy if, say, one side is asking a lot more questions of the black jurors? And I'm guessing that they're trying to put a big list together for all the reasons why they're going to strike them, even though it's because they're black, and that the white jurors are just two or three questions. Doesn't that kind of show the pattern that you could prove in Batson? Like, hey, this was unfair.
Yeah, I mean, the third step in Batson is pretextual, that the defense attorney should have had the opportunity to come back and say these reasons that they're giving are pretextual. Give you an example. If they struck somebody and they said he was unemployed, and the defense can say, well, two other people were unemployed on the panel that you didn't strike. You just happened to strike the one African-American that was unemployed. So obvious evidence of pretext and pretense. And I just don't see, you know, if the judge saw that, he had the power through Batson to throw this jury out and start over. I think it's crazy.
It's been fascinating to watch, and we're not over yet, so I'd love to have both of you back again. Thank you, Mark O'Mara. Thank you, Ronald Beaton. Appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Ashley.
Be well.
Okay, so coming up, can Tiger King 2 possibly compare to the original? If you are like me, you watch a lot of TV, and during the pandemic, you probably watched way more than you should have. Tiger King may have been top on your list, and even if it wasn't, I'll bet you know a whole lot about its star, Joe Exotic, an imprisoned, gay, polygamist, private zoo owner with a penchant for bad language, glittery clothes, and revenge. If you didn't know, Joe went to prison for plotting to have his rival, big cat enthusiast Carol Baskin, murdered. 22 years, hard time. Now Joe says he wants out, barely a year in. And Carol wants out, too, of the Tiger King sequel. And she's gone to court to try to get her way. Joining us now is attorney Darren Cavanocchi. He's host of Investigation Discovery's Deadly Sins. Great lawyer and a really good guy, because you might not know it, but today is his 26th anniversary with his wife, Olona. And he actually pushed his plans to make sure that he could do this segment. So I am just going to say thank you right off the bat for being you and then doing that as well. And please give Olona my love and tell her thank you.
Thank you, Ashley. It's great to see you. It's been way too long.
It has been. So let's jump right into this. He wants compassionate release because he says he has prostate cancer. But last I checked, there's loads and loads of infirmaries in prisons and lots of prisoners who get cancer. How often does it actually happen that you can get out, you know, a year or so in?
Yeah, compassionate release requires extraordinary and compelling reasons to justify that release. And historically, only a handful of prisoners get released each year under the compassionate release program. And unfortunately, many people die while they're waiting for their applications to be processed. Donald Trump signed the First Step Act in 2018 with the idea of expanding that compassionate release program. But in Joe Exotic's case, he definitely has some legal challenges in front of him, because some of the factors that the court's going to look at are going to be the extent of his illness. And at this point, I believe it's unknown what stage cancer he has. Generally speaking, the court will grant or will be more inclined to grant a compassionate release for somebody with a terminal illness diagnosis, which has been defined as having 18 months or less to live. Yes.
Okay, can I ask you, Darren, I kind of wonder if he had, do you have to have a doctor's note? And I know that sounds stupid, but not only do you have to have a doctor's note, but does the victim have any say in any of that?
Well, definitely the court will hear from the victim in the case and will certainly balance the interests. I mean, what the court is ultimately concerned with is recidivism and public safety. And so there will be an opportunity for a full hearing in all likelihood, where we'll get to learn some of these details. The things that Joe has going against him would include his short stay in prison. As you point out, the opportunity to perhaps be treated while in prison. And of course, it's a very serious crime that he's been convicted of, which carries
22.
Which stacks the deck against him even further.
Does it ever?
Such a small portion of that.
like I think only 8% or something crazy so far. So, okay, you mentioned the business about the victim. I when you said hearing, I thought Tiger King 3. Like, I want to see that live courtroom hearing. But when we come back after the break, I'm going to ask you about that victim, Carol Baskin, because she's making some news of her own saying, don't you dare Netflix drop Tiger King 2. And we're going to talk about that. Darren Kavanoky next.
At all. You haven't quite seen it all.
The plot to kill Carol is built on lies.
These people are going down.
You think this was Waco?
Come get me, mother.
Back now with Darren Kavanoky. That was the trailer for Tiger King 2. I mean, I can't wait, but apparently Carol Baskin can. Darren, she filed for a temporary restraining order saying, I never okayed any of this. And the judge said no. Why is that? How can they go ahead with a documentary with her in it if she said, I never agreed to it and I never signed a deal for it?
Well, first of all, the devil's in the details, right? So I'd like to see that paperwork and see exactly what she signed. It may be different than what she now wishes she had signed. But the key thing to remember is this. When it comes to an injunction, which is really what she's seeking here, to shut this down before it ever gets off the ground, the key is that there's no adequate remedy at law. And what the judge decided in this case is that there is, in fact, an adequate remedy at law that she could sue for monetary damages if the film is released and she's somehow damaged by it. Frankly, when the film is released, I think so many people will be watching it, and I'll include myself in that camp, that she may actually benefit from the exposure. So it'll be interesting to see if she can make out any damage claim.
Damages is one thing, but how about just back-end royalties? Like, you put me in there, why don't I get a cut of it? Can she sue for that? I only got 10 seconds.
Well, there again, I want to see what that paperwork says before I can give you a credible answer on that one. But whatever that paperwork was that she signed, she's going to be living with it.
Yeah, I'm going to be in your camp, and I'm going to text you all through it saying, did you see that? Did you see that? Yeah, I love that, Tiger King. Hey, once again, happy 26th anniversary, Darren Kavanoky. And also say same to Alona, and tell her thank you for lending some of your time to us tonight. Appreciate it.
Oh, you're so kind, Ashley. Always a pleasure to see you.
Thanks, Darren. We'll see you all tomorrow night on Banfield, everybody. Thanks for being here tonight.